of radiation are among the major goals pursued by the AEOI as part of the Comprehensive Strategic Plan for the Nuclear Industry. That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do tune in again, same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
History of Knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Most historians believe that the great bulk of progresses in human sciences and civilization is indebted to the Iranian scientists and civilization. As it was said in the previous episode of this series, UNESCO had dubbed last year as the International Year of Basic Sciences for Sustainable Development, that is IYBSSD 2022, to mark the importance and role of sciences in human life. Please stay with us for the second part of this series. Perhaps you have noticed that some powers, regimes, and governments make serious effort to divide nations and ethnicities into civilized and uncivilized ones. They try to change history and even names of places, events, and persons so that the nationality of a scientist or a scholar is not recognized easily. At times, these powers and regimes totally deny the move and endeavor of a nation or people toward progress and growth. Such unfair efforts began in 17th and 18th centuries and continue to date. If we consider knowledge as conscious dealing with nature, we will accept that mankind has always lived with knowledge. In other words, the man who lived nearly 100,000 years ago used to try hard for better life. Current sciences, including math, are the result of the whole mankind all over the planet. Different peoples in different ages were in different levels of civilization and, relying on their intellect and experiences, intended to discover the laws of nature to have a better life. Basic mathematical concepts like quantity and shape have always been with man, and generally speaking, math has had a life as long as man. Math, however, didn't mean the science of numbers in the ancient worlds, but it was quite tangible in buildings, water structures, tools, and equipment. For instance, the rules of math can clearly be seen in the construction of Achaemenid palaces, mapping and making of the means of transportation, such as ships and chariots. Some of the mathematical principles and rules, such as algebra tables and equations, were quite common in the ancient Shush or Susa in southwestern Iran. The devising of measurement units by Iranian mathematicians spread these concepts to vast areas of those days. The remnants of that era indicate that Iranians were notably aware of geometry. Many Greek scientists benefited from Iranians in this field. Pythagoras, as a founder of geometry, registered Pythagoras' theorem in his name after his journey to the East and benefiting from the Iranian scientists. This is why historical documents bear witness that the geometricians of Shush knew the theorem well, but they had failed to present it publicly. In the 7th and 6th centuries BC, the Iranian culture was transferred to Babylon and North Africa. Iran's cultural contact with Greece was quite common during the 5th and 6th centuries BC. And although Alexander of Macedonia assaulted Iran and devastated many cities and ancient monuments, Iranian culture spread to Greece and the adjoining regions. During the Parthian rule, some of the savants of Sistan, that is eastern Iran, went to India and founded mathematical and astronomical traditions over there. They were known as Magus Brahman. The noted Iranian mathematician Brahma Gupta had apparently remained from those people. Iranians were the founders of algebra and trigonometry. The concept of number was formed in Iran as a variable quantity. Dynamic equations were broadly pursued to put the foundations of non-Euclidean geometry. This was the basic for Western Europe to follow up the endeavor. If we'll have a look at the theoretical aspect of math, we can divide it into four eras, including Era of Formation of Awareness and Mathematical Concepts. Number 2, Era of Elementary Math. Number 3, Era of Math with Variable Quantities. And number 4, Era of Modern Math. Iran passed through the first era till the 7th century AD and stepped in the second era of progress from the end of the 8th century till early 9th century, and entered even the third era in some domains. Of course, with regards to the remaining documents and also archaeological discoveries, this category can change a little. During the first era of math, the concepts of this science were in close relation with people's daily needs. Counting of livestock, division of agricultural lands, establishment of temples and palaces, building of bridges and dams, securing of provision for warriors, and so on. More advanced phases included calculations pertaining to trade, shipping, securing of water needed for agriculture, and digging of qanats, or underground water canals. Naturally, with the start of city dwelling and emergence of powerful states, mathematical methods for solving of problems developed alongside increase of needs. Math was at the service of man in this era. The era of elementary math was the time when concepts and rules became abstract while keeping their relation with the scientific and social needs. The Elamites ruled from 4th century BC in the south and southwest of Iran. Powerful Elamite states ruled vast regions from their capital. They had common borders with Sumerians and then Babylonians and enjoyed the system of slavery like those two neighbors. The close relation of Sumerians with Elamites included broad cultural and commercial dealings and continuous wars and skirmishes. Thus, in some spheres, it is very hard to separate cultural progresses of these two nations. Elamites left such a rich culture through 35 centuries whose impact has remained in all eras of the Iranian civilization. Although little has remained of the Elamite civilization, the Elamite language and writing was used during the next eras, such as the Pars. Math in Shush, like in the neighboring countries in Mesopotamia, was in close relation with people's routine needs. Few mathematical texts that have been found from Shush show that mathematicians of the region were mainly priests and soothsayers who had got access to a kind of numeric system and even many abstract deductions of elementary math. Elamite mathematicians were well acquainted with mathematical rules of triangles and polygons. Although there is little document remained on progresses in math during 1,200 years, spanning the 6th century BC till 7th century AD, it is obvious from the architecture and artistic works of the era that engineering had remarkably advanced. Astronomy and music, as two sciences closely related with math, climaxed in this era.
We say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
More than 10% of Americans over the age of 12 use antidepressants. Antidepressants are among the most frequently used medications in the United States. Newly released study shows how antidepressants help bacteria resist antibiotics. Global survey shows that in 2019, antimicrobial resistance killed more people than HIV/AIDS or malaria. The fentanyl drug crisis is on the rise in the United States. Fentanyl is a cause of overdose. While the country's drug epidemic killed close to 110,000 people in 2021, it seems the drugs that are meant to cure people are making the population sicker. Sick on drugs. The United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention announced that, at the end of May 2022, close to 40% of American adults had experienced symptoms of depression and anxiety during the past month, a quarter of which received antidepressants or other psychiatric drugs. The New York Times also reported that, between 2017 and 2021, American teenagers' use of antidepressants rose by 41%. Most adults that feel depressed do not take antidepressants, but the total number of the ones that do are still staggering. More than 10% of Americans aged 12 and above take antidepressants in the United States. This is while in 1990, less than 3% of adults had taken these drugs.
I think in this country, certainly stigma has really changed in the last 20 years, and certainly with our younger population, they're talking about anxiety and depression a lot, whereas people, you know, in my generation and older didn't talk about it so much.
Being unable to connect with large groups of people in the way that, you know, humans are used to. It was really hard just to wake up, you know? Being asleep was my favorite thing about the day because I didn't have to be awake and be thinking and wanting to be with people but not being able to.
The rise of the use of antidepressants is while Nature magazine recently published a study stating that antidepressants are causing drug resistance and resistance towards antibiotics in particular. Chinhua Guo, the author of this study, working at the Australian Centre for Water and Environmental Biotechnology at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, became interested in the possible contribution of non-antibiotic drugs to antibiotic resistance in 2014. Why is it that so many Americans take antidepressants?
I think the first thing to look at is that these figures parallel the decline in the rise, if you like, of inequality in wealth inequality in America, and also the decline in living standards of many, many Americans, specifically lower income Americans who have really not seen their wages and their work compensation increase substantially for over 30 years. And it's only just in this very last period from COVID that there's been any increase at all, but that's still less than inflation. That's the major cause.
Chinhua Guo reported that even though antidepressants are a completely different class of drugs, they are driving bacteria to develop resistance against antibiotics. He adds that even after a few days of exposure, bacteria develop drug resistance, not only against one, but multiple antibiotics. This would mean that antidepressants may help the rise of superbugs in the environment or the human body.
Without changing people's habits and developing new drugs quickly, drug resistance is going to pose a huge threat to human health. And it's going to do so in our lifetime.
The findings of this new study is extremely important and alarming. Antibiotic resistance is a significant public health threat throughout the world. It is estimated that 1.2 million people have died as a direct result of antibiotic resistance in 2019, and the number is only expected to climb. In fact, global survey shows that antimicrobial resistance took the lives of more people in that year than HIV/AIDS or malaria did. What does the findings of this recent study mean for the United States?
When it comes to precise interaction of drugs, antidepressants or antibiotics and other kinds of treatment drugs, for infections and so forth, the issue, these precise mechanisms that can take place really have to be studied by expert biochemical, medical, chemical researchers. And there are interactions. But secondly, you have a lot of co-conditions among Americans concerning their health. If they are taking antidepressants or antibiotics, you have a very high rate of obesity. People are fat. They are depressed. That strains the organs in the body. It creates a disposition for more illness of all kinds, respiratory problems in the gastro and other systems. So there is not automatically a simple relationship of antibiotics and antidepressants, but you've created the conditions for very bad interactions.
Interestingly, with the harmful effects of antidepressants on the environment and humans now coming to light, another study has shown that antidepressants and psychiatric medications over time may not be doing anything in improving the overall quality of life of the patient. In a study on millions of Americans, after 2 years, those taking antidepressants reported feeling no better regarding either physical or mental quality of life issues than those not taking the drugs.
For decades, we thought that the primary pathology, the primary cause of depression, was some abnormality in these neurotransmitters, specifically serotonin or norepinephrine.
However, norepinephrine and serotonin did not seem to be able to account for the symptoms of depression in people who had major depression. Instead, the chemical messengers between the nerve cells in the higher centers of the brain involved in regulating mood and emotion, which include glutamate and GABA, were possibilities as alternative causes for the symptoms of depression.
Dr. David Katz, the founding director of the Prevention Research Center at Yale University and president of the Preventive Medicine Advocacy Organization, said that he was not surprised by the study findings, adding that antidepressant drugs tend to be only nominally effective even in the short term. He also added that much of the impact of the drugs is because of their placebo effect.
I think, you know, the overuse of antibiotics has antidepressants, and that has been documented for a very long time. And we all know that it reduces people's immunity. That's the very first thing. It goes into, you know, through animals, through the food supply chain, and then enters back into human bodies in that way. And of course, then what happens is people who are eating this kind of low quality food are then also, you know, taking drugs, antidepressants, and other kinds of opioids, for example, that is causing them to get other diseases. And for example, there's a study just released not very long ago, a couple of weeks ago, about the extraordinary rise of syphilis in, I think it was Mississippi, one of the states in America. Extraordinary rise in syphilis. And a lot of this has got to do with that antibiotics, also to do with the fact that hospitals are still very, very overcrowded in America, and access to getting testing and prenatal care and things like that are quite difficult for many Americans. You know, only 16 Americans are fully covered by Medicare or Medicare aid, and that leaves a very, very large proportion of people in America without a health or safety net.
In the 70s, the American Psychiatric Association, APA, fearing to lose its legitimacy, sought to brand psychiatrists as medical doctors who are treating patients with diseases. This rebranding also called for a different definition for depression, so that depression would be known as a disease that would require medication for treatment. Not surprisingly, pharmaceutical companies jumped aboard, campaigning in support of so-called depression awareness so as to make the billions of dollars they are making today off psychiatric drugs.
What's called Big Pharma, the very large famous pharmaceutical chemical medicine producing houses like Merck, AstraZeneca, many other kinds of AstraZeneca, many other kinds of companies. They have been allowed through deregulation for 30 or 40 years to just play the market and produce mood drugs for antidepressants and other things, and not have the support and direction and ordering by the national government of what kind of research and what kind of manufacturing of medications would be in the public interest. Because instead of making profits, which is all right, it's fair enough, by producing reliable and good drugs, the companies have switched to producing opiates of all kinds and even raising certain kinds of medicines and mood drugs in abroad from the United States. And this should instead, they should be ordered, induced, and pressured to produce the vaccines and the medications, both for the U.S. and wherever needed internationally. This is a matter of the public welfare.
There are little evidence to prove that antidepressants are actually helping psychiatric patients, while there are many that show that they are in reality harming them. 6 out of 7 psychiatric patients report that they experience drug side effect without any benefit. The most common side effect may be sexual dysfunction, which at times lasts long after the patients stop taking the drugs. This side effect can cause problems that might make the patient feel depressed as a result. What is being done to limit the use of antidepressants and antibiotics that cause drug resistance?
You know, the decent health experts and doctors and medical specialists do recommend, do not misuse and widely use antibiotics. It's better to have your farm animals as well as your population be in the best circumstances to be able to naturally resist microbes, viruses, and bacteria. And the best way to ensure that is for high technology family scale farms, so the farmer can make the decision, does an animal need an antibiotic, but only get it under certain circumstances.
Millions of Americans suffering with psychiatric problems and depression turn to antidepressants or other drugs to try and relieve their suffering. The COVID-19 pandemic and its effect on the economy and living elevated depression and drug use. Many Americans coping with psychological disorders or pain turn to other drugs in hope of finding relief. One such drug is the dangerous fentanyl drug, which can be purchased by prescription or illegally in the black market.
Well, the existent problem is already very large, and there's very many deaths. And what we've seen is that the United States government has made efforts to blame everybody else. You know, they've said that Mexico is, the source and the causing the drug problem. They've said that all of these drugs are coming from China and China should do more about these drug problems. That opium and other drugs came from Afghanistan and they should do more about that. So this, of course, is obfuscation. I mean, this is not the real cause. The real cause is demand, and that demand is being caused because people do not have the education, do not have the health standards that are required and needed, that Big Pharma is making profits at the expense of the health of the nation, even though they, obviously say they're helping by the development of their drugs, but actually they're profit-making and they don't really think about this, and there's very few controls on them. And mental health, of course, also is on the rise in the United States. And look, all of this equates to the way that the United States is being run. It subjugates its trade policy and its domestic policies to foreign policy. It spends enormous amounts of money that it has to borrow because of the power of the dollar to fund all of this. And it's that in itself is decreasing the purchasing power of the dollar and undermining the salaries and wages and services, health, education, infrastructure in the country. And I think, that's going to continue. And wealth inequality in America is the highest anywhere. And I don't see any end to this problem. I don't think that the government is making any true effort to realize an end to this problem. They're just passing the buck and blaming everybody else.
Fentanyl is a strong opioid drug that is often prescribed when other sedative or pain relief medication is not enough to relieve the patient's pain. Fentanyl, however, is found to be addictive, and not only that, some experts believe that the drug itself makes it extremely difficult to start addiction treatment. Fentanyl is a main cause of drug overdose, which has taken the lives of nearly 108,000 Americans in 2021.
There is a plague of drug use in the United States, and in fact, it's so bad that the leading cause of death of Americans between the ages of 18 years old and 45 years old is drugs, directly through overdose or otherwise through indirect debilitation and sickening of their bodies. So the widespread prescription or black market use of synthetic opioids like fentanyl and others has reached extreme proportions. And in addition, sometimes there are other things that contribute to the likelihood of death connected to it. There's a substance that's used in veterinary for animals as a tranquilizer, and that's added into fentanyl. And it's been very bad in Philadelphia and New Jersey. So there are many stories about this, but overall, this is an epidemic of drug use resulting in the actual increased death rate in the United States.
The drug epidemic is alarming in the United States. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's 2021 National Survey on Drug Use and Health discovered that 16.5% of the American population, which makes close to 47 million people aged 12 and above, had a substance use disorder in the past year. 24 million individuals were classified as having a drug use disorder. How does prescribing fentanyl and its addiction side effects affect the high number of drug overdose deaths in the U.S.?
Fentanyl is a big problem. So the opioid addiction in America, and not just in America, but other advanced economies, but America has the worst sort of outbreak of this. And as I said before, it's very much related to lower living standards, low salaries, and the depopulation of country areas. You see, a lot of this problem with opioids is not only in big cities, where you might think it's going to happen in big cities, but it's actually happening in poorer rural areas as well, or semi-rural areas, where there's a big lack of cultural and other kind of health services, educational services, those sorts of things. And this mostly affects people with lower education standards, and that's quite a few people these days in America, because it's so expensive to go to university. And the worst affected group are those that have not finished high school. And in America, that's surprising, but that number is very, very big. Yes, the side effects of this, of course, are, you know, there's violence, all the drug crime, rising prison populations, all sorts of problems like that. Mostly this, of course, is the same group of people. This is lower income groups with lower education levels.
Now, with the surge of opioid addiction and drug overdose, the Biden administration is trying to curb the crisis by reforming and liberalizing federal rules for treating opioid addiction. This would include relaxing the prescription of drugs such as methadone, which is unavailable to Americans who do not have access to special federally approved opioid treatment clinics. Regular physicians are not allowed to prescribe the medication, even though they can prescribe opioids. What would be the future of the drug epidemic in the U.S., and what should be done to stop it?
If the United States, on the positive side, stop the geopolitical kind of warfare orientation and instead moved for economic development and started rebuilding railroads, collaborating in the Americas for water projects with Canada and Mexico, where you had a whole prospect for the population of good jobs and a future for families, you could push down the dependency on drugs. And in addition, we need a cultural shift to go with this. That is, there has been a very bad counterculture from Hollywood and from London and elsewhere for decades for depraved music, the drug culture, that it's clever to take drugs, and for bread and circuses, like in the days of the decline of Rome, where everyone is completely oblivious by being involved in sports, which on their own is a fine thing, physical activity. But people's lives have been so destroyed by the lack of productive employment and a future and hope. If this is done, things could be turned around.
It would not come as a surprise if Big Pharma would also be behind the push to relax rules and regulations for treating opioid addictions. Some might argue that treating a drug addiction with another drug would defeat the purpose. Methadone itself is an opioid that might cause physical dependence and addiction. So whether it is patients taking opioid to relieve the pain or feed their addiction, or if they intend to cure their addiction, they would still be filling the coffers of Big Pharma. That is what is called a win-win situation for pharmaceutical companies.
Big Pharma is a very big problem because it's a kind of a strange cycle, isn't it? I mean, these drug companies promote to doctors the prescription of their drugs. This has been famously documented everywhere. Doctors going on holidays to Las Vegas and so forth, paid by drug companies. And so there's sort of kickbacks, if you like, for doctors that prescribe more of those drugs. And so they're very freely promoted and prescribed. And the government keeps widening that window to allow more drugs of these kinds, opioids and antidepressants and so forth, to be prescribed. And then they're prescribed mostly to the people that, you know, I'm not going to say that people don't need them, but I'm going to say that to groups who, as we've talked about before, lower income, lower education, they don't really understand medical and health situations, and the doctors are obviously promoting these drugs to them. And the health companies, of course, make a lot of money out of this. And we know that during COVID, for example, and the mRNA-type COVID vaccines, it was the US government that funded the research and development of these drugs, but it's the pharmaceutical companies that are keeping the profits. They're not paying back the government and taxpayers that money. And so this is also the problem related to, antibiotics in farms and in animals, also with opioids and antidepressants. It's a kind of a vicious circle. The pharmaceutical companies make a lot of money. The doctors then promote the use of these drugs, and then the people that use them have more health problems and need to go back to their doctors. And look, this is a vicious cycle, and Big Pharma needs to be controlled more. But I think in America that's going to be very difficult. The rise of Big Pharma is a real problem, an economic and social problem.
Antidepressants and other forms of drugs are used frequently in the United States. Health experts are concerned over the use of these drugs that is now being revealed that not only has very little or no benefit to the user, it harms others and the environment by causing drug resistance and the creation of superbugs. Pharmaceutical companies, however, are only concerned about their profits. So with the doctors and politicians all benefiting from the sale of drugs, there is little hope in controlling the so-called Big Pharma.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
During the eight-year war and aggression against Yemen, the aggressor Saudi-led coalition has completely demolished 162 health centers in Yemen and partially destroyed 375 medical centers. During this period, 66 medical personnel were martyred by direct bombing of the aggressor coalition and 70 ambulances have been destroyed. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Ansar Allah news website has covered this story and tells us more. Yemen's Ministry of Health warned of a human catastrophe that threatens the lives of more than 5,000 patients with renal failure as a result of the years-long Saudi-led blockade against the impoverished nation. Ali Jahaf, National Salvation Government's Deputy Health Minister, made the remark at a press conference in the Yemeni capital Sana'a late on Saturday, 14th of January, as he raised the alarm about the depletion of the stock of dialysis drugs and medicine for Yemeni patients suffering from chronic kidney failure. Ali Jahaf added, "This is not the first conference, and we have held more than one. We have been warning of a human catastrophe threatening the lives of thousands of dialysis patients in various governorates, but there is no response." He added, "We have addressed the United Nations and health organizations operating in Yemen that we need to provide sufficient drug stocks for dialysis sessions for the year 2023, as we need approximately 500,000 dialysis sessions every year without receiving a response despite loss of correspondence and meetings in this regard." Stressing that dialysis centers in Yemen are standing on the verge of collapse, Ali Jahaf said, "The issue will affect the lives of 5,000 patients with kidney failure who need dialysis sessions and drugs, and they may lose their lives if these solutions and medicines are not available urgently." Yemen's Deputy Health Minister underscored the importance of opening Sana'a Airport and yet the Yemeni port of Hodeidah, as they are vital outlets for medicine and food for millions of Yemenis in the besieged areas of the country. The Deputy Health Minister of Yemen added, "In light of the imposed blockade, we are unable as a country to import vital medicines and save our patients." Ali Jahaf went on to say, "We are in urgent need within 2 weeks to provide dialysis sessions and our stock of medicines has run out." Anis al-Asbahi, a spokesman for Yemen's Ministry of Health, also called on international organizations to urgently provide dialysis sessions so that dialysis centers in Yemen would continue to operate and save the lives of patients. Anis al-Asbahi held the United Nations responsible for saving the lives of dialysis patients and responding to the basic requirements of the Yemeni people who are currently under a Saudi-imposed siege, stressing the need to open Sana'a Airport and the Yemeni port of Hodeidah. The website of the World Health Organization, WHO, has also covered this story. Over 8 years of war and aggression in Yemen have resulted in a massive setback to an already weak healthcare system and led to a dramatic collapse of healthcare services provided to the Yemeni population. More than 20 million people out of the total population of 30 million Yemenis require healthcare services in 2023, while only half of the health facilities are fully functioning. The dialysis centers also face a severe shortfall of essential supplies such as medication and fuel to run hospital equipment, as well as a lack of funds to pay healthcare workers regularly. Via has been working as a nurse in Al-Sadaqa Hospital's dialysis center in Aden for at least 8 years. She has witnessed the torment of kidney failure patients and the decreasing capacity of the hospital to treat the patients properly. Via said, "Without dialysis, consumables and supplies, the suffering of these patients is unbearable. But because of the lack of medical supplies, we often had no other choice than to reduce the duration or the frequency of the dialysis sessions." Dr. Abdul Wahab Al-Nehmi, non-communicable disease officer at the World Health Organization country office in Yemen, said, "Limited access to dialysis sessions and treatment puts the lives of these vulnerable patients at higher risk, not to mention the suffering they go through and their families through because of the lack of medical treatment." Despite the efforts of the World Health Organization, WHO, and non-governmental organizations in coordination with health authorities in Yemen, significant gaps remain due to funding shortages and because of a lack of a humanitarian response in Yemen. Continued support is needed to save the lives of the most vulnerable people in Yemen, including patients who are suffering from renal failure. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Health officials in Yemen's capital Sana'a have warned that over 5,000 renal failure patients are at risk of death because there may not be enough essential supplies to keep local dialysis centers going. Fear and anxiety ran rampant in the renal disease ward of the Al-Thoura Hospital in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, which provided dialysis treatment for hundreds of patients every day. According to Hamdan Salamin, the hospital's deputy director, a severe shortage of medical supplies is the most pressing problem at the dialysis center in the hospital. He warned that if the center runs out of supplies, it may have to close, which is expected to happen soon. Ali Al-Ezi, one of the patients, said, "The closure of the dialysis center will be a great tragedy for the renal disease patients like him." Ali Al-Ezi complained while taking his dialysis. He said, "Life has been already very difficult in Yemen. Our salaries were cut for years and the price of medical treatment and medicine is soaring. Many of us had to sell our possessions to obtain the required medical treatments." Ali Al-Ezi said, "Now it is a matter of life and death now. If we can't get access to our treatment, we will die." Grinding into its 8th year, the Yemen war has ravaged more than half of the country's health facilities, cut off wages, reduced imports, caused serious shortages of medical supplies throughout the country, and pushed more than 20 million Yemenis to the brink of famine. The Ansar Allah movement's health authorities released a statement recently stating that hospitals in the capital Sana'a and the regions under their control will run out of medical supplies and other essential supplies for renal disease treatment by the beginning of 2023. Salamin said public hospitals are the last resort for many renal disease patients in the war-torn country because the majority of them could not afford to go to private health clinics. He added, "We call on the international community for urgent help so that we could find a solution and save the lives of thousands of Yemenis." Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the United States and other Western countries, has launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015. The objective was to crush the Ansarullah resistance movement in Yemen, which has been running the country ever since.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Be friends with the merciful God from your early childhood. This is a part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Taklif celebration for a number of schoolgirls on the eve of the birth anniversary of Imam Ali alayhi salam, February 3rd, 2023. The advice I wish to give you young people, my advice to my dear daughters, is that you become friends with God. Try to become friends with the merciful God from the start of your youthhood. What is it like to be friends with God? One of the ways of becoming friends with God is when you are talking with God in prayers to pay attention to this, that you are talking with God. You are speaking with God. Learn the meaning of the words in prayers. Learn from your elders and teachers the translation of Surah Al-Hamd, Surah Al-Ikhlas, and what you are saying when you are bowing and prostrating. When you pray, pray in such a way that you are talking with God. This is becoming friends with God. This is one of the ways of becoming friends.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another way of becoming friends with God is to be careful to avoid the deeds that he has told you not to do and to do the deeds that he has said you should do. This is the way to become friends with God. Today you have bright hearts. You have shining hearts. You have pure hearts. Become friends with God from today. Now you said this beautifully in your anthem. You said that this is Iran, your country, dear Iran, had great women in the past, and I can tell you that today the number of outstanding women is much more than in the past. We have important outstanding women in all the scientific sectors, in applied work, in jihadi activities and positions of responsibility, in management, etc. These things are a source of pride. Outstanding women in a country is a source of pride for any country that has outstanding women. And there are many such women in our country. You too must try to become one of these women. How? Study your lessons. You should study your lessons well. You should do your homework well. Work, think, and read books so that, God willing, you will be one of these great women in the future.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all. were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For most people in Gaza, it's just a dream to travel and explore the world outside the Israeli cruel blockade. The new generation has lived almost all its whole life under the Israeli siege, learning about the world only through screens. The longest-standing Israeli restriction on the movement of people and goods to and from Gaza has undermined the living conditions of over 2 million Palestinian residents.
The idea of this festival is that children of Gaza rarely travel abroad. And it's hard to get out of Gaza to discover the countries around the world. We sought to bring the world's countries to our children and introduce the different cultures through a collection of famous Flint statues, food and clothes, cultures in general.
Al-Amal Institute for Orphans in Gaza is an independent non-governmental organization that pursues to bring about positive change in the culture of the community and raise awareness about the orphans and their needs in order to ensure a better life for them and their families.
Yahala from around the world comes as a message to the whole world that Palestine is also part of the world. Therefore, this message reaches the world that the crossings should be open to facilitate traveling for our children and us, so we can visit these countries and communicate widely with the neighboring and other countries.
The Israeli blockade of the occupied Gaza Strip in its current form has been in place since June 27, when Israel imposed a full-scale land, sea, and air blockade on the area. The siege contravenes Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment that prevents the realization of a broad range of human rights. Three Gaza children died in 2022 as a result of the Israeli occupation authorities' delays or refusal to grant them permits to exit Gaza for medical treatment.
We hope such event has a positive effect on our students, and they are part of the history and the glory, and they are capable of breaking the siege and the Israeli blockade want to break their will. They have a great civilization, and this affects their psychological and social well-being.
The beleaguered Palestinians in Gaza live in a cycle of a struggle, located, imprisoned, and denied basic human rights and needs. Now entering its 18th year, the Israeli blockade created a generation seeing a window to the world outside. These kinds of events are a glimmer of hope for the children who one day want to break the siege and restore their right to freedom of movement. Ulal Asi, Gaza.
Terrorism laundering, a term which Iran's foreign minister's two-day visit to Geneva will be remembered by.
Addressing the 52nd session of the Human Rights Council at the UN headquarters, Hossein Amir Abdullahian did not mince his words when it came to elaborating on the fact that Iran had been a victim of an unprecedented propaganda war. He said the rights of the Iranian nation were completely ignored during that war, launched by the same countries claiming to be advocates of human rights.
The role of anti-Iran terrorist groups in the recent crisis in my country was evident. Some states were involved in t-